Is he even being prepared because of everything we've heard? Being prepared to give up, so now we're in chapter 7. Yeah, where Rupa Goswami is giving evidence regarding the 64 items that were described before. Because the Goswamis, what they did is they went through all of the literatures and pulled all the different, important verses and explanations that one would establish properly the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. Because it's very important that what one's speaking in it is established on the Veda, on the Shruti. Shruti and Smriti. The Veda is evidence from that, because that is then coming down from the Lord, from the Great Personality. So then what we speak is in line with what they are saying. Then it's a matter of our understanding, our realization, establishing it in our own life. That's what makes it then perfect. This idea of trying to, that the need to establish it for the individual, that's very important, but the need also to establish for the individual something that is coming down in tradition from the Lord, from the Acharyas, that is equally as important. So that balance and make things work. Otherwise, how do you know it works? You know, every day someone comes up with some nice speculative idea, which sounds great, may work in a particular situation, change the situation, it doesn't work. So, the idea is that the Veda, it should always be able to apply. It means, like in the modern, you have your white rat, or your white fish. And so any scientist in the world can run the experiment and get the same result. But the problem is that's only the external, the principle on which that experiment works. That is unknown. If it was known, then why do you need a white rat? You could use any rat. You understand? So the Vedic principle is everyone's a unique individual, so it has to be able to be applied to each individual. So understanding the principle, then we can apply it to everyone. That's the meaning. It means it's not that everyone becomes similar like this. No, it's a matter of everyone has their uniqueness, you have to be able to apply it to that. Right? That's where you start from. There'll be a commonality of community, commonality of philosophy, but the particular position an individual is, that will be different. Right? Does this make sense? So this balance between the tradition and the application to the individual is very important in the Vedic understanding. Right? In the modern, it's become separated. Someone is in the tradition, someone is into applying things to the individual, but they don't go together. The Vedic principles, without the two going together, then it won't work properly, it won't work perfectly. Is that even it? Okay. Being prepared to give up everything material for satisfaction. In the Padma Purana, it is stated, quote, "For one who has given up his material sense enjoyment, and has accepted the principles of devotional service, the opulence of Vishnu Loka, the kingdom of God, is awakening." So the sense gratification means that we're separating ourselves from the reality of what's there. Engaging the senses is not called sense gratification. Like when you take prasadam, even though the senses are engaged, you don't call that sense gratification. Sense gratification means that you're engaged in the material environment, in material activities, but not connecting it to Krishna. Right? That is the meaning. Does that make sense? I mean, when they come like that, you take that left arm and try to put it on the nap side of the kid, it works a lot better. That means the left arm. You're on the left knee, yeah. Like that. Then they're happy, they sit there, they're peaceful. Right? What they do is they flitter around and get some attention here, they go get some there. They get attention, they're quiet. They don't get attention, they make a lot of noise. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, the kid, this is what the kids ask. So if you give them the attention, that's not mine. See, now they're going to get up and walk off, they can let go. Right? That's all you get. That's the way it is. You understand that, you won't suffer so much in the material world. If you understand, that's all that is. So come on. it doesn't matter if it's 2 years old or it's 20 years old. It's the same species, right? So the sooner you get used to it, the sooner it works. Does that make sense? So that's the point. It's not Maya, it's not this and that, because it's just you're dealing with the inherent nature.
That is, the demigods see the inhabitants of Jagannath Puri as being beforehand.
when there was a meeting of great sages in Nainishadri, Supa Goswami was reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, and the importance of the Ganges was stated as follows. The water of the Ganga is the water of the Ganges are always carrying the flavor of tulsi offered to the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. And as such, the water of the Ganges are ever flowing, spreading the glories of Lord Krishna. Wherever the waters of the Ganges are flowing, all will be sanctified, both externally and internally. So you see, it's the sacred place that is what is connected to Krishna, and it is what it brings about purification. So then living next to the Ganga, staying in the holy places, then the benefit is that one is purified internally, externally. One is established as the Lord's associate, right? So this is what we're trying to do, is qualify ourselves as the Lord's associate, you know? Then that makes it more nice. Accepting only what is necessary. In the Naradiya Purana, it is directed. One should not accept more than necessary if he is serious about discharging devotional service. The purport is that one should not neglect following the principles of devotional service, nor should one accept the rulings of devotional service, which are more than he can easily perform. For example, it may be said that one should chant the Hare Krishna mantra at least 100,000 times daily on his knees. But if this is not possible, then one must minimize his chanting according to his own capacity. Generally, we recommend our disciples to chant at least 16 rounds of the Japa beads daily, and this should be completed. But if one has not even able to chant 16 rounds, then he must make it up the next day. He must be sure to keep his vow. If he does not strictly follow this out, then he is sure to be negligent. That is offensive in the service of the Lord. If we encourage offenses, we shall not be able to make progress in devotional service. It is better if one fixes up a regulative principle according to his own ability than follows that vow without fail. That will make him advance in spiritual life. In other words, focus is very, very important. So what it is that one can do, one does that. Right? One focuses on it. Better to do something sustainable that you can do every day than to do something that's beyond what you can do. Festival days, that's the day for doing what's beyond. Because it's a special day, it comes occasionally. When those come, then you can do something. You're not good at fasting on that day, you try to fast, or you know, you chant only so many rounds, and that day you can chant more, or you can do a service, or you know, whatever it is that one is trying to do. That is the time when one does it. Right? This is the time. Otherwise, daily one tries to do something that's stable, one's steady. Just like learning, let's say, like mridanga, and you learn mantras, you play these beats, so you repeat them. The tendency is of the new students try to play as fast as they can, and they make mistakes, start off slow, and try to go as fast as they can. But actually, you learn the maximum when you play at a speed that you don't make any mistake at, and play that as long as you can. That's where you actually learn, because by doing that, then it becomes habit. It automatically increases. Right? Does that make sense? So in the same way, is don't accept more than what you actually need. If you don't need it, don't accept it. If you do need it, why you won't accept it. But the point is what can be engaged properly in the Lord's service, that is what you use, what you keep. If you can't engage in the Lord's service, then that's not.
How do we judge what we need or not?
What you need or not. What are you going to do with it if you have it? You have it, what will you do with it?
Either...
You know what I'm saying?
We should try to use it in Krishna service?
We should try to use it in Krishna service, but the point is do you get the thing first, then figure out how to use it, or you have service to use it for, therefore then you get it.
The second one.
Yeah. So it's not that, you know, well, everyone's got a phone, maybe I should get a phone, and then afterwards figure out, well, what should I do with it now? Depending on what kind you have, a great paperweight, so you have a very solid state, you know, you can hold down a lot of paper. Some of the cheaper ones, then won't hold. ignorance act. So you have to figure out what it is, what is the service that you want to perform and what it requires. If you know what I'm saying. Not that I just get something that someone else has it or looks interesting and then I figure out what I'm going to do with it. Observing fasting on Ekadasi. In the Brahmad Vaivarta Purana, it said that one who observes fasting on Ekadasi day is free from all kinds of reactions to sinful activities and advances in pious life. The basic principle is not just to fast, but to increase one's faith and love for Govinda or Krishna. The real reason for observing fasting on Ekadasi is to minimize the demands of the body and to engage our time in the service of the Lord by chanting or performing similar service. The best thing to do on fasting days is to remember the pastimes of Govinda and to hear his holy name constantly. So roughly, these different Puranas, so Brahma Bhagavata is presenting, because generally those who are, it means that one is maybe interested more in the pious elements. So here pious also, devotional service is a piety, but it's a transcendental piety. So here is that for those, for the devotees, then that is what they mean by piety. They're interested in those pious activities that generate pure love of God. So then by fasting on Ekadasi, then one is freed from all kinds of reactions, because sinful activities, they tend to hold back one's devotional service because one's mind is distracted by other things. So by being freed from the sinful activities, then one's mind is not so distracted. That leaves better focus. So then on Ekadasi, by the fasting, then one is purified, and by that fasting one can focus more, because one's reducing the normal bodily demands and focusing more on specific devotional activities, you know, and specifically here then remembering the Lord. So by increasing one's hearing and chanting, then one establishes oneself better in devotional service. So this Ekadasi is one of these nainmittic or occasional activities. So this is the time when one does beyond what one normally can do. Right? So Ekadasi is a regular, like every 2 weeks that you have it, so then that opportunity is there. And then other festivals, you get somebody at one time, and then for many months you don't have family like this. But Ekadasi is something that regularly we can be performing special activities, something beyond, you know, what we can do, try to increase. Like that. If there's any questions at any time,
Maharaj, on Ekadasi day, is it not enough to just do the fast and then continue with your day if you want?
You would do that. That's the part. That's important. Just by doing that, then so much benefit is there. But the idea is generally the fasting has a tendency to reduce time spent on bodily activities. And the idea is that time saved, you would use for hearing and chanting. You know, so instead of eating, let's say, 3-4 times a day, or eating even less or not at all, so those times could be used, you know, at some point to increase one's hearing or reading or some kind of devotional activity. And that then, you know, besides the fasting that you're getting the benefit for, then the real purpose is actually to increase one's remembrance of the Lord. Is that okay? Yes.
What actually means fasting, like, because on Ekadasi days, though you don't eat grains, but you end up eating the things that you can eat on Ekadasi more, like the way we used to eat on normal days as well. Is it still fasting?
Yeah, I mean, the basic principle is fasting means no grains or beans, right? Like that. Then you take more than that, is, you know, maybe reduce how much times you're eating, you know. know, it's not that you have to reduce the amount, it's just a matter of, you know, instead of eating just any time you feel like it, you regulate it, focus it. If you want to do less than that, then you stick to, you know, just fruits and roots, or fruit and milk, or just milk, just fruit, you know, anything, just the idea is that you can simplify that, still eat. If you want to do further than that, then you can just not eat. You know what I'm saying? Or, you know, say at a certain time of the day, you only eat after, you know, once it gets to noon time, or until, you know, later in the afternoon or something. Does that make sense? So in other words, the idea is that you have something that is, you know, in that line of fasting. The basic thing is no greens. It means you can eat what you want, how much you want. That's just that much in itself. Then you get the benefit of the ekadasi, you know, like that. And then try to, you know, use some time extra for hearing chanting. If you're reducing the number of times eating or like that, then that itself also frees up time, like that. So the point is just to not eat grains and to try to increase one's remembrance of the Lord. That's the basic. These others are details of how you can do that.
You can do more than the break in the past in the evening time.
Say again?
Next morning, when there is a break in the past, is it important in that time exactly to...
Traditionally it's followed in that time, because normally what happens is you don't fast on Dwadasi. And so then, the ekadasi, what you're doing is the timing generally is from sunrise until the first quarter of the day. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the normal thing. From the sunrise to sunset, you divide that by four. So the first quarter, that's generally then what is used for breaking the fast. Because that's normally the time when you would take breakfast and other things anyway. Sometimes that is shortened, that the quarter of the day is not short, but it's the earliest, because the ekadasi tipi itself extends beyond the sunrise. So that's why sometimes you see it says that from, you know, 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock, or sometimes, so that is very narrow, you know, 9:05 to 9:20. That's only because the ekadasi extends up to 9:05. So that's the actual aspect of the technicality. If you know that, nice. If you have accessibility to it, nice. If you don't, then the basic thing is, you know, in the you know, morning time, that's when you break the fast. Does that make sense?
Because somebody explained me before that because we don't fast usual. So, it's not important to bring the fasting
at
that time.
No, but fasting is fasting. Nirjala is one day a year. You know, saying where that vow is. If you want to do more than that, but the point is just you're breaking the fast after a ekadasi is over. That's the main point. You know, in other words, you fast on a ekadasi, you break the fast the next day. That's the main point. You don't have to worry too much. If it doesn't work for you, you don't have availability of specific times, then don't worry about it.
Can you explain why you don't fast?
Yes.
Sometimes we have a Kadashi in the next day, we have like Varadadashi or after the last we have Prabhupada appearance and we have fasting. So how do
people break water? You don't. But you're fasting then on the ekadasi.
How do you want to open Varahadvarasi?
Varahadvarasi and Vamanadvarasi is the same thing. Fasting is done on the ekadasi. So whatever fasting you want to do for Varahadvarasi, like fasting till noon, you do that on the ekadasi. Because if you want to see, then you'll break the fast. It doesn't mean you have to eat in the morning. It just means you break the fast. How is appearance day? That's another, because that is that's a different principle. Janmashtami is not ekadasi, but the tradition is this sense you're fasting, you're doing these serious fasting. Part of a festival means there's special remembrance, there's a special observance, and there is a feast. So the difficulty is that having fasted all day, it's not a great time for a big feast. So therefore, in tradition, on the Vishnupatsa appearance days, then you fast for grains. Not that it's a codicy, not that you couldn't take grains, just generally one doesn't because of the fasting, it's just a little bit, one, it's more difficult on the system, and two, feast means grains. So that's why the next day is the festival. Right? We see like Janmashtami, then the festival is the next day. Right? Then it's, you know, Nandosa. Or in Bel Purnima, the feast is the next day. You know, Jagannath Mishra Uposa. So, like that, that's just, it is practical. You know, I've been fasting all day, very hard to put together so many different things. No one's really that hungry anyway. Like that, but the next day, you know, then everybody is, you know, very, I would say, enthusiastic. That makes sense. It's a whole lot easier to, you know, sit down and have a proper feast and, you know, interaction with devotees and serving the next day, you know, at noontime than it is to do it at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, when everyone's thinking about going home or going to bed or something. Does that make sense? What are the options? Some say you follow on Dwadasi, but some say that you leave it because Dwadasi you don't fast and do it on Friday. Like that. Does that make sense? Doesn't make sense. If you don't follow it one day, you follow it the day after. Does that make sense? Okay. So some fall the next day or the day after that. You know what I'm saying? It's 2 days after it, obviously. But the Dwadasi, then that's when the one is not. Yeah. I think Calcutta we followed it the next day. Some men are cooking with peas and the sushi, so everyone goes to Kadasi. Probably a servant wasn't there for months, he was on months of service, he came back, he was hungry, everyone told him don't eat. He was very upset. You know, he thought, well, everyone else broke, why, I won't break. But then the next day, when everybody was fasting, you know, for a Kadasi again, then Prabhupada wasn't, so he was eating grains. And so because the servant had fasted on Kadasi, then he got all the Prabhupada's mama. So then at that time, he understood his fortune. The day before, he was not very good. But there they just followed up the next time. Does that make sense? Offering respect to the Vandian treaties. In the Skanda Puran, it is directed that a devotee should offer water to the Tulsi plant and the Loki trees. He should offer respect to the cows and to the Brahmins and should serve Vaishnava by offering them respectful obeisances and meditating upon them. All of these processes will help the devotee diminish the reactions to his past sinful activities. So this is then, we're respecting the Lord, respecting his place where he resides, the holy places. Here it is, we're respecting that what is connected to him. This is Pada Sevana. So it means worship of Tulsi, worship the devotees, the Brahmins, the cows, that kind of respect. Then it is, you know, very purifying, very pleasing to the Lord. Because the Lord is always working on the principles that, okay, you have a nice attitude towards him, that's good, that's what you want. But at the same time, if you have a nice attitude to those who are connected to him, that's even better. Right? I mean, so you respect him, you respect what is connected to him. Right? Like you like, you have a friend, you like him, but you can just ignore his family. That's not as pleasing as you would deal with him nicely and you deal with his family nicely. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the natural. Giving up the company of non-devotees. Lord Chaitanya was once asked by one of his household of devotees what the general behavior of a Vaishnava should be. In this connection, Lord Chaitanya replied that a Vaishnava should always give up the company of non-devotees. Then he explained that there are two kinds of non-devotees. One class is against the supremacy of Krishna, and another class is too materialistic. In other words, those who are after material enjoyment and those who are against the supremacy of the Lord are called a Vaishnava, and their company should be strictly avoided. It doesn't mean that people who are involved in dealing with the material world, it means where their focus is dealing with the material world. That's materialism is their purpose. Right? Or they're atheists. Like that. They don't like Krishna. They don't like the Lord God. So this is what's meant by leadership company non-devotees. In the Katyayani Samhita, it is stated that even if one is forced to live within a cage of iron or in the midst of a blazing fire, he should accept this position rather than live with non-devotees who are through and through against the supremacy of the Lord. Similarly, in the Vishnu Rahasya, there's a statement to the effect that one should prefer to embrace a snake, a tiger, or an alligator rather than associate with persons who are worshippers of various demigods and who are impelled by material desire. In the scriptures, it is instructed that one may worship a certain demigod if he is desirous of achieving some material gain. For example, one is advised to worship the sun god if he is desirous of getting rid of a diseased condition. For a beautiful wife, one may worship Uma, the wife of Lord Shiva. And for advanced education, one should worship Saraswati. Similarly, there is a list in the Srimad Bhagavatam for worshippers of all demigods, according to different material desires. But all of these worshippers, although they appear to be very good devotees and demigods, are still considered to be non-devotees. They cannot be accepted as devotees. The Mayavadis, impersonalists, say that one may worship any form of the Lord and that it does not matter, because one reaches the same destination anyway. But it is clearly stated in the Bhagavad Gita that those who are worshippers of the demigods will ultimately reach only the planets of those demigods. For those who are devotees of the Lord himself will be promoted to the kingdom of God. So actually these persons who are worshippers of demigods have been condemned in the Gita. It is described that due to their lessened desires, they have lost their intelligence and have therefore taken to worshipping the different demigods. So in the Vishnu Rahasya, these demigod worshippers are forcibly condemned by the statement that it is better to live with the most dangerous animals than to associate with these persons. Because materialism is their goal, so therefore they're approaching the demigods for those material goals. And so then, by association, one doesn't want to gain the same purpose, the same drive. Because by those who you associate with, you take on their values. Right? So one has to be very, very careful about this. So then it is because your value system is what actually makes you who you are. Right? You value God consciousness, therefore you live that lifestyle and make that determination. But by associating with materialists, one might change that value. Or the impersonalists who are saying that, you know, anything goes, doesn't matter what you do, you get to the same goal, then it's the same problem because that's atheistic. It's like saying, yeah, go down to the, you know, central station and take any bus, get on any bus, and they'll all take you to the same place. Okay? You know? Like that. And then, you know, that would be foolish. So it's actually that foolish. They think just because it's spiritual, nobody can necessarily seemingly confirm it, so therefore they can say whatever they like. But the Shastras don't do that, don't support that idea. So one should be very careful. Thank you. not accepting unfit disciples, constructing many temples, or reading many books. Another stricture is that a person may have many disciples, but he should not act in such a way that he will be obliged to any of them for some particular action or some favor. And one should also not be very enthusiastic about constructing new temples, nor should one be enthusiastic about reading various types of books, save and except the ones which lead to the advancement of devotional service. Practically, if one very carefully reads Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, teachings of Lord Caitanya from this nectar of devotion, that will give him sufficient knowledge to understand the science of Krishna consciousness. One need not take the trouble of reading other books. In the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 13th chapter, verse 8, Narad Muni, while discussing with Maharaj Yudhishthira the various functions of the different orders in society, especially mentions rules for sannyasis, those persons who have renounced this material world. One who has accepted the sannyas order of life is forbidden to accept as a disciple anyone who is not fit. The sannyasi should first of all examine whether a prospective student is sincerely seeking Krishna consciousness. If he is not, he should not be accepted. However, Lord Chaitanya's cause of mercy is such that he advised all glorified spiritual masters to speak about Krishna consciousness everywhere. Therefore, in the line of Lord Chaitanya, even the sannyasis can speak about Krishna consciousness everywhere. If someone is seriously inclined to become a disciple, the sannyasi always accepts it. In other words, the principle is that you only speak to those who are interested, to those who are sincere. But in the public forum and these kind of things, even though the rule is to only speak to those who are sincere, one can speak. And then those who amongst those are sincere, they come forward, then they may be accepted as disciples. Right? But one is not doing this to increase like that. I think this is the next point. The one point is that without increasing the number of disciples, there is no propagation of the cult of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, sometimes even at a risk, the sannyasi in the line of Lord Chaitanya, Mahaprabhu, may accept even a person who is not thoroughly fit to become a disciple. Later on, by the mercy of such a bona fide spiritual master, the disciple is gradually elevated. However, if one increases the number of disciples simply for some prestige or false honor, it will surely fall down in the matter of executing Krishna consciousness. And so, in other words, the person is sincere, maybe not fully qualified, but if it works, then they may be accepted. But to accept people just to increase one's status or economic position, this should not be done, because then one will fall down, right? Because there's nothing spiritual about this. There's no recommendation for this. Lord Chaitanya is giving some space, because in Kali Yuga, then those who are interested in Krishna consciousness many times are mixed. It's said that in the Satya Yuga, in the Golden Age, then the demons and the devotees live on different planets. Right? You see, like, the demons live in the lower planets, and others live on the high, the demigods live in the lower planets. Then you see in the Treta Yuga, then in the Silver Age, then it would be that they would live on different, same planet, different continents. Right? So Rama is living in India, Ravana is living in Lanka. So the difference is 800 miles, you know, south, so it's a different place. Then in the Dwapara Yuga, then there are different families. Like you see, the Pandavas are in one line, the Kauravas are in a different line. But it said in the Kali Yuga, they live in the same body, like that. So therefore, then you have the element of, you have the devotional qualities, and then you have the non-devotional qualities. So the idea then is, by performance of devotional service, by associating with devotees, then one can control the non-devotional and encourage and increase the devotional. That's why then so much is mentioned on association and on performing activities which purify one and make one advance. Does that make sense? Yes.
My question, devotees at times go through different phases, the lean phase where the plant goes down, and a phase where you're very happy with what you're doing and you want to further it. So in a phase like the lean phase, what must you do to come out of that phase. Maybe it may be very individual, depending on what a person is involved in, day-to-day routine, but again, confirmation.
Well, it's the same way, just someone is getting too skinny what you tell them to do. Stand on his head. What do you tell him? No idea. Have you connected that the eating process has to do something with health and weight and stuff like that? Yeah? Okay. So, therefore, if one is involved in more Krishna conscious activities, that will take care of the meanness. You know what I'm saying? Like that. That's the idea of sadhana bhakti, the idea of duty. Duty is something that you perform whether you're inclined or not. Because that's the point. Inclination or non-inclination is something to do with the mind, not necessarily that it's correct or not. You know what I'm saying? It's just like sometimes you feel like taking your medicine, sometimes you don't. But taking your medicine is the proper thing. Therefore, that's why then bhakti or this regulation in devotional service is so important. That's what I mentioned before. Make a sadhana that works. So that when you're encouraged, you can always do extra things. But when you're not encouraged, then that much you can do. You will always do that. Does that make sense? So the idea is to be steady. Steadiness is actually what's important. Because this principle works in everything. Some days you don't feel like going to work, but if you don't go to work, you lose your job, so therefore you go. Or you don't feel like being, you know, sensitive or nice in the family, but you have to be. That's the duty, that's what's expected. And by doing that, everything works nicely, you know. So that's the whole idea of the culture, of the tradition, of duties, is that that regulation will create prosperity, like that. So, despite us, it's good works. That always means the unknown principle is not a devotional process, right? Or the proper performance of duties. That's very clear. The Shastra says what happens. The unknown factor, you know, the X factor, is us. You know, we're the weird ones. You know, like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The association with devotees. Sometimes I find it much easier to associate with people that aren't devotees, or I find it even nicer sometimes to associate with people that aren't devotees.
But that's nice, but we're talking about what works.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? Like cyanide doesn't taste bad. In fact, I think they're still trying to figure out the taste. I think they got it down to an S. But the problem is that the people who take it are dead before they get past S. So it's either salty, sweet, or sour. I'm not quite sure yet. You know what I'm saying? So the point is like this. The materialist will be nice, that's what they have. They're not nice, they don't make their profit. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, by etiquette, by their own ego, they must be nice. Especially the more they're involved in material energy, the more expert they are at it, generally the nicer they are. Like that. While the less they're expert at it, the less they're successful, sometimes they get a little rough around the edges. Difficulty with devotees is that if they're working on the principle of not working with the false ego, at least how you say, in their own mind, what they're aware of. Not that they may not be, but it's just they're trying not to. And they're not materially motivated. Sometimes then they forget to be nice. Because those are the things that motivate materialists to be nice. So it's actually generally just a neophyte state. Is that they're kind of in between the two. They're trying to give up the material platform, but they haven't actually situated themselves so strongly on the spiritual that then again all nice qualities come out. You know, like that. So even though it's sometimes a little rougher, then you find those amongst the devotees that you like associating with and associate with them, and those that are a little more rough around the edges, then be pleasant with them, you know, properly behave, but you may not get so close with them. Does that make sense? Yes.
My question is about associating non-devotees.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if your parents or close relatives, they're not atheists, but they believe in all gods, and if you tell them in a nice way, they can listen. So, should we...
Should we tell
them in a nice way and then get them to actually...
Is there any advantage to telling them in a not nice way?
I mean, in a family you should be a bit sensitive and...
Yes. So the point is, since it's a family, then there's no other way than nice way. But factually, for anyone, there's no other way than nice way. So that's why then in the scriptures that it talks about proper dealings and the etiquette and everything, because the idea is it all has to be dealt with in a nice way. Does that make sense? The teacher can be, parents like this can be sometimes sharp for the purpose of creating awareness, but it can only be done for their own students, because outside of that, those people aren't interested. Does that make sense? So The principle is that what is presented nicely then tends to be the more readily accepted. So if you can deal nicely and get the result, why would you deal any other way? The point is, if they like you and you found something very special, there's the possibility that they might also start to take interest. Especially the mother, right? What the son's into, the mother has a tendency to be interested in. Once you catch the mother, you have the rest of the family. Right? Does that make sense? I forget where it is. What country it was in. I'm sure it wasn't China. That they found in the preaching, you don't catch the mother, you get nobody. You can catch whoever you like, but you won't keep them. But so therefore, when they go in, they focus and convince the mother. And once the mother's convinced, that's it. The whole rest of the family is going to be eating prasad. it works. Similarly, a bona fide spiritual master has no business reading many books simply to show his proficiency or to get popularity by lecturing in different places. One should avoid all these things. It is stated that sannyasi should not be enthusiastic about constructing temples. We can see in the lives of various acharyas in the lines of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that they are not very enthusiastic about constructing temples. However, if someone comes forward to offer some service, the same reluctant acharyas will encourage the building of costly temples by such servitors. For example, Rupa Goswami was offered a favor by Maharaj Man Singh, the commander-in-chief of Emperor Akbar, and Rupa Goswami instructed him to construct a large temple for Govindaji, which cost vast amounts of money. So a bona fide spiritual master should not personally take any responsibility for constructing temples. But if someone has money and wants to spend it in the service of Krishna, an acharya like Rupa Goswami may utilize the devotee's money to construct a nice costly temple for the service of the Lord. Unfortunately, it happens that someone who is not fit to become a spiritual master may approach wealthy persons to contribute for temple constructions. If such money is utilized by unqualified spiritual masters for living comfortably in costly temples without actually doing any preaching work, this is not acceptable. In other words, the spiritual master needn't be very enthusiastic for constructing temple buildings simply the name of so-called spiritual advancement. Rather, his first and foremost activity should be to preach. In this connection, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj recommended that spiritual master print books. One has money, instead of constructing costly temples, one should spend his money for the publication of authorized books in different languages for propagating the Krishna consciousness movement. In other words, that someone, that's how they are inspired, they can be engaged in building a temple, then that is done. That works nicely. But the spiritual master doesn't take that responsibility. That is taken by others. That's their his service is preaching. So you don't need a fancy building to preach like that. The main point is preaching. But if those people want to build something very nice so that people can congregate there, you can do nice worship, then that's very nice. It's good. You know, they'll engage them. Like here, the example is Man Singh. So he was the commander-in-chief of Akbar's army, who was the emperor. He was very powerful, very wealthy. So in those days, then they were, you know, everything that is in stone, everything is done by hand, so they had so many workers working, they worked for 20 years. That wasn't because they had a small budget, it was a very big budget, but still it took them 20 years to build the temple. So that's something fit for someone of this capacity. Does that make sense? They're that wealthy, they can organize it so that they do it. Then they're nicely engaged. Like that. But otherwise, just to build some place to live in comfortably, then that's not very important. Like the point is to preach. Like that. It's not that the temple can't be comfortable, but that can't be your purpose in making it. Just to live comfortably without preaching. So preaching has to be there. So then it's nice, people are comfortable, and it's good. So like Prabhupada encouraged the devotees to build like places in Mayapur, because he said if he just sat down on the bank of the Ganga, who would come? You know, not that he couldn't sit down under the tree, but no one else would come and sit there. Right? Once a journalist then asked about why you have your sadhu, you know, you're a saintly person, why you have all these buildings and so much opulence in that. He said, if Bhaktivedanta Swami sat down under a tree, who would come to see him? He says, you wouldn't be here now. You're a journalist. Would you be here because I'm sitting under a tree? Yes. Swami sits under a tree. No. There's thousands of millions of Swamis sitting in the trees. No journalist is coming forward. That makes sense. In other words, so there is the preaching element like that. Temple will create preaching, will create attraction, people will come, therefore then you can preach, you can teach. Then it has value. Straightforwardness in ordinary dealings, and equilibrium in loss and gain. There is a statement in the Padma Purana, persons who are engaged in Krishna consciousness should never be disturbed by some material gain or loss. Even if there is some material loss, one should not be perturbed. But one should always think of Krishna within himself. The purport is that every conditioned soul is always absorbed in the materialistic activities. He has to free himself from such thoughts and transfer himself completely to Krishna consciousness. As we have already explained, the basic principle of Krishna consciousness is to always think of Krishna. One should not be disturbed in material loss, but rather should concentrate his mind upon the lotus feet of the devotee should not be subjected to lamentation or illusion. There is the following statement in the Padma Purana. Within the heart of a person who is overpowered by lamentation or anger, there is no possibility of Krishna being manifested. So lamentation is that in the loss, anger comes in frustration of loss. So both these conditions, then the Lord will be there. Because the material world is designed in such a way that it's never really going very well. Right? At best you can get 50% like that. We all want 100%, but that's not realistic. 50% is good. Right? So we noticed it before that the question was, is, you know, when everything's going nice, then we're Krishna conscious. When it's not going nice, then we're not. So this is the principle that's being talked about here. Because when it's going nice, then yes, then, you know, it's going good, this religion is nice. When things are not going so nice, then it's something wrong with religion, why I should be practicing. right? The religious gather the truth, right? The difficulty is that's one way of looking at religion. The other is looking at it is that religion is the gateway of consciousness. Because the nature of the soul is to serve God. So that's religion. Religion means the activities or the qualities of something that cannot be changed. Right? That makes sense. This is the actual definition of religion. Like sugar is sweet, you can't change that. You change, if sugar's not sweet, you don't call it sugar anymore. Right? Fire gives heat and light. You can't change that. So the nature of the soul is to serve God. That can't be changed. Right? The nature of the material world is what is. God is who he is. Right? So then understanding this, then there are activities that are natural for the living soul to connect themselves with God. So these are inherent things that they do what they do because of their nature. Therefore, that's religion. It's not the ritual. Ritual is part because the conditioned soul needs ritual. Because the living entity works on the principle, I perform an activity, I get a result. So therefore, when a ritual is performed, then I'm confident there'll be a result, right? It's something observable. But the actual ultimate principle is that we're trying to develop a natural position in relationship to God, right? And so these other aspects become part of that religious process because they work according to the inherent nature. Does that make sense? Much of the time we take it that the religion is its form. The form is there to carry the actual application of your nature. Does this make sense? Doesn't make sense.
Come on.
Huh?
Getting there.
Lost. In other words, let us say you give a gift to somebody out of appreciation. So is the form of it what's important, or is the expression, or the form is something to express the mood of appreciation? Does that make sense? So the form is important because it properly expresses that. But at the same time, it ultimately is something beyond. So in other words, if someone gets too caught up in the form, then you have to point out what's actually what's beyond the form. That's why you get seemingly contradictory statements where the form of Krishna consciousness will be encouraged, but if someone gets too much into that, then that's put on the side because that's not actually what you're trying to do. Right, the form is the natural expression, right, according to the nature of what you're dealing with, but the form is not actually what you're trying to obtain. Right? So those who are more externally, conditioned, then you'll put more emphasis on the form, because all they work with is observable items, so therefore if they perform things that are observable, then for them, they are involved in the religious process. As they mature and they're able to appreciate the more subtle aspects, then that will then start to be emphasized more. Does that make sense? Something else? Yes?
Nature of the soul. Each and every quality means there's each and every activity that the underlying factor developing love. It pretty much defines things. All this activity naturally results to that. Unfortunately, for material things, it's easy to fall in or get attracted to, say, for each and for years and years. For example, years for years, you get half to get paid for it. At the same time, if you just hear three points of a girl, you immediately get attracted to. So the nature of the soul, even though being religious, being spiritually situated, how the material attraction is too easy or too.
It's easy. How? Okay, you can sit down and chant for 2 hours, right? Like that, or chant all day. How often and for how much length of time do you hear the sweet voice of a woman? In reality. You understand? So because it's something you're looking for, when it occasionally happens, then it's noted. But it's not something that's going on regular. You know what I'm saying? At best, if you're an expert, you might get it 50% of the time. You know what I'm saying? But chanting, it's always available, always there. So therefore, we might, you know, just out of habit, just deal with it and not focus. You know, we just take it for granted. You know what I'm saying? But you don't have the girl, so the sweet voice sounds attractive. But if it's your girl, then you may not be as take it so seriously. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, that's why then the philosophy is given that you will look at it and balance it actually more realistically. You've been chanting for 10 years. You haven't been hearing, you know, sweet feminist voices, you know, that consistently for 10 years. So you can't really compare them. Does that make sense? So that's the material energy. It's just now and again, just before you're about to drown or give it up, then, you know, then there's a little sweet voice. You know, just to keep you from going over the edge. You learn that science, you might survive. Prabhupada ki jai.